Oh, give me a home where the buffalo roam. Wait, wait, what's this? A buffalo in the house?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 551st edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Acrodalia, Cyprus, who are tuned in as we stream along the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, there was a time when buffalo roamed free across the grasslands of America. Sometimes their numbers were so vast that observers could not see the land beneath the buffalo. And while on the hoof, those buffalo provided for one of the most magnificent food chains of all time. But that was then, and this is now, which leads us to ask, can there be a home where the buffalo roam? And who better to ask than Richard Rosen, author of A Buffalo in the House. Richard, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks very much, Michael.
There actually was a home where a buffalo roamed, and you wrote about it in A Buffalo in the House, and that was a real buffalo in a real house.
Indeed. There was a home when they roamed. It was called the United States of America. Buffalo roamed in every state in this country except Upper New England at one point.
But you found a house where there was a buffalo roam, an actual house.
I found an actual house in Santa Fe where a middle-aged couple lived. And I stumbled on them a few years ago, and they had had raised a baby bison from the an orphan baby bison from the age of 1 week. By the time I met Charlie, the bison, he was 2 weeks old. But this couple had quite a story to tell.
And you kind of tracked along with it there, didn't you? Followed them and their adventures as the story developed and enveloped. You were there to kind of keep track of this.
Exactly. I was reporting the story as it happened, so to speak. I had to reconstruct what had happened in the first 2 years, but then I was writing a book without knowing how that book was going to end, because, in fact, the reality was still going on.
Well, when I heard that somebody had written a story about a buffalo in a house, you know, a real buffalo in a real house, I hearkened back to some of my Montana boy adventures growing up in Montana, and I, of course, you know, had some buffalo adventures up there, but none greater than, I think, than my sister Bonnie, who was a school teacher in the little town of Gardner, Montana, which is at the northern entrance to Yellowstone Park. And she lived in Cook City, which is at the northeast entrance to Yellowstone Park. So Sister Bonnie had this wonderful commute through the Lamar River Valley back and forth to work, which was quite spectacular, it being, you know, some of the most beautiful country on earth. But in winter, it could be another story. And on her way home from Gardner to Cook City through the Lamar River Valley, it's the only road in Yellowstone Park that they plow the snow. And so the snow was like 7 feet tall on each side. So you're kind of like going in down the chute for 50 miles before you get home. Well, it was one of those very, very cold winter nights, and she came around a corner, and there in the middle of the road was a big, huge, hoary buffalo bison standing there looking at her and unmoving. And you write about this characteristic of a buffalo where when they have a notion not to move, they simply don't move.
I'm sorry. I was just going to add very quickly that when I was in Yellowstone last a few summers ago, and this happens quite regularly there, a bull bison was standing alone in the middle of the road in the Lamar River Valley, and had stopped traffic in two directions for half a mile. And nobody was foolish enough to get out of their car and ask the gentleman to leave.
And there in my sister Bonnie, you know, in the middle of one of those deathly cold Montana winter nights, you know, when it 20 degrees below zero, you know, it's so cold the spit freezes before it hits the ground. And there she is, you know, and standing between her and home was this big, huge buffalo. And there's no place for him to go because there's just the road, you know, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And no place for her to go. And so when you tell the story of a buffalo in a house, I get to thinking, oh, you got to be kidding. But when I picked up this story and took it to the beach with me, I thought it was a wonderful story. And not only do you talk about how a middle-aged couple in Albuquerque, New Mexico, picked up a little baby motherless bison and weaned it, but it's also the story of the American Great American West and what happened to the buffalo and how the fates of this couple intertwined with the fate of her great grandfather Charles Goodnight.
Great uncle. Mm-hmm.
And so it's really quite a tale, and filled with this wonderful sense of serendipity, and how you kind of tell a story about the resurrection or the attempt to save the buffalo from extinction. So take us back kind of quickly to a time before white man, describe what the buffalo were like in the great American West and throughout the country, actually.
Well, as far as we know, when we were still in the 18th century, there were buffalo everywhere, as I said, except upper New England. By the beginning of the 19th century...
No buffalo in Boston, right?
No buffalo in Boston, New Hampshire, Vermont. I don't think they like the winter weather very much. They're very smart animals. By the beginning of the 19th century, they had disappeared from east of the Mississippi.
Why is that? I often wondered.
Pardon?
Why is that they disappeared from east of the Mississippi?
Well, buffalo have a tendency to disappear where human civilization is developing,
mm-hmm.
Partly because they provide food, shelter, and many other important artifacts.
They got eight, in other words.
Yeah, they got eaten and they got used. The Indians probably taught the colonists how to use various parts of the buffalo for weapons and arts and crafts and tools, etc. So they were gone by the beginning of the 19th century, and by the middle of the 19th century, we had basically eradicated all the buffalo west of the Rockies. Again, the Oregon mm-hmm. Trail had to be fed. Of course, we had American Indians who were living off the bison. The entire culture of the Plains Indian is built on the bison. And the story I've written relates this sort of love story in the present between a middle-aged man and a baby bison, a very unusual baby bison, to his wife's ancestor, Charles Goodnight, who in the 1870s, Charles Goodnight, very famous Western figure, cattle breeder, cattle rancher,
mm-hmm.
he took a look around in the 1870s and realized, along with his wife, that if they didn't do something, the buffalo would soon be extinct. We wouldn't see any except in, you know, museums of natural history.
Before we go there, tell us how many buffalo actually existed out there in the prairies. I mean, I've read the journals of Lewis and Clark and have been a great fan of Plains history, and they talk about these incredible numbers that they talk about there being so many buffalo you couldn't see the land beneath them.
Exactly, or being in a spot where a herd passed and it literally took days for the herd to go by. Some estimates were that there were herds as big as 10 miles long, possibly several miles wide. It became kind of a game trying to estimate the number of buffalo.
Wow.
We didn't have airplanes to make it a little easier to get an aerial view. The best guess is that in the middle of the 19th century, we still had between 30 and 50 million buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that there were more buffalo than people in America in the 1850s.
And then what happened?
Well, what happened, a lot of things happened. It became a very, very bad time to be a buffalo.
I guess.
Very bad time. A number of things happened that were inimical to its survival. To begin with, one of the key things, the Sharps rifle was developed.
Mm-hmm.
first rifle we could kill an animal at a distance of several hundred yards.
What really happened is that white folk discovered the economic value of parts of the buffalo, right? I mean, there was value in the tongue, there was value in the hide, and they became a commodity.
The hide became very valuable for the first time to a large economic market. Previously, they provided clothing and shelter for the Plains Indian.
Right.
But new tanning processes in America and in England that were developed sort of at the same time, they figured out how to use buffalo hide to make high-quality belting leather.
Okay. We're going to have to take a quick break. Richard Rosen, author of A Buffalo in the House. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We will be right back. Please do stay tuned. We're back. This is Michael Olson. We are talking with Richard Rosen, who's the author of A Buffalo in the House, an incredible story of about a middle-aged couple in Santa Fe, New Mexico, who raised a buffalo, but it goes much farther than that because this middle-aged couple was connected by ancestry to one Charles Goodnight, who was a cattle rancher that roamed the prairies of Texas a long, long time ago and was largely responsible for maintaining or keeping the buffalo from going entirely extinct. Would that be a fair comment to say?
I think it's entirely fair to say that if it weren't for Charles and Marianne Goodnight and a very few other people who by accident or design started their own herds, we would not have buffalo today. We would have lost the species
entirely. All of those
entirely.
Those tens of millions of buffaloes that were roaming the prairies in 1850 became commodities, as we were talking about. We learned how to make great leather out of them, and we learned how to enjoy the buffalo tongues, and it became a delicacy, and it also became a sport just to shoot them, right?
Well, finally, yes, it did become a sport, and it's fairly well known that the wealthy sportsmen and their wives often and foreign dignitaries would get on trains, travel out west, stop in the middle of a buffalo herd, lean out the windows with their rifles and their sharps, and shoot buffalo. And shooting buffalo has been likened quite accurately to shooting a parked car. Buffalo never learned to really fear men. And for whatever reasons, if you shoot a buffalo, the others don't scatter. They crowd around. They're very family-oriented. And they nudge the fallen buffalo, and they try to save him or her, making it even easier to shoot more buffalo.
So you could just sit there and pick off buffalo all day long.
So, yes, at the very end of this slaughter of the American buffalo, which, with one exception, has to be the greatest slaughter of living creatures in the history of man.
And the Indians had a wonderful name for these rifles. What was it?
Shoots today, kills tomorrow.
In other words, here's a rifle that could shoot a long ways and kill.
Exactly.
So you could just sit there on a hill and pick off buffalo forever, and that pretty much became a very well-paying job of the time, correct?
If you could kill upwards of 50 buffalo a day, and some people could kill 100, you were making more money than anybody in the United States at that point, with the exception of a couple industrialists. You were making more than the president of the United States.
Wow.
So there was tremendous incentive to drop what you were doing, go out west if you were, you know, had a little bit of the frontier in you, and kill buffalo. But, you know, we're leaving out the chief reason why the buffalo disappeared so quickly, why we had, let's say, 30 or 40 million at the end of the Civil War, and by the early 1880s, we literally just had a few dozen.
And the real reason was?
The real reason was, and this was, in fact, official American policy, you could get rid of the Plains Indians as a threat by getting rid of the buffalo. Their culture was based on the buffalo, mm-hmm. Eliminate the buffalo, and they couldn't survive as a culture.
Which is pretty much true.
Yep. And it's actually quite sad, even today, and for the last 100 years, how cut off Plains Indians are from the basis of their culture, buffalo. Mm-hmm. And there's a story in the book that's really rather touching about the Taos Pueblo Indians and how alienated they are. So alienated from the buffalo that Charlie, the bison in my book, was taken to show to the school children there so they could, for the first time in their lives, see a buffalo up close and touch one.
And, of course, the buffalo was the foundation for their food chain forever.
Exactly.
Until the white man came, yeah.
Exactly.
And at this time, Charles Goodnight and his wife Marianne were cattle ranchers, one of the first cattle ranchers in Texas, right?
Correct.
And Charles was most fortunate to find a woman who would marry him, and he took her way out to the sticks, and she became a very lonely gal out there, but she managed to make some friends with some chickens and had Charles go get some buffalo.
Charles was, by all accounts, a fantastic husband and puts a lot of us to shame. He realized the hardships that he was subjecting his wife to. She lived alone in the Paladuro Canyon except at night, and chickens were sometimes her only company. A cowhand had brought her a few chickens thinking this would make a nice meal. Instead, she recognized that these would be perfect companions for her and kept them as pets. Finally, Charles gave her a grandfather clock with this beautiful inscription thanking her for putting up with all this hardship.
Mm-hmm. And the canyon of which you refer was a home to a great buffalo herd at the time, was it not? And this as a time when the slaughter was happening, and Marianne was greatly troubled by the shooting. I mean, she lived with the shooting day after day after day, and the great slaughter of the herd.
There was a herd when he began the J.A. Ranch, and by the 1870s, that herd was virtually gone, and you could hear the killing of them every day. There were so many hunters out there. And Marianne finally said to Charles in 1876, I believe, you know, honey, can you rope out a couple orphan calves? And there were many orphan calves, of course, at this point. Rope out a couple, let's start a herd. If we don't do it, people will never see buffalo again. And let me just add, because we want to connect this to the story in Santa Fe.
Right.
So now 130 years later.
Well, Earl wait a minute. First of all, you have to talk about how she bottle-fed these buffalo calves, right? How Marianne actually bottle-fed them, weaned them.
Yes. And they became the foundation of the Goodnight herd.
Right.
Whose descendants now are in Yellowstone National Park. They're in Caprock in Texas. And they are the basis for the Taos Pueblo buffalo herd, the one I mentioned before, mm-hmm. that the Taos Pueblo Indians have almost no connection with. But nonetheless, they're there, and none of those buffalo would be there were it not for Charles Goodnight.
So your protagonists in modern-day Santa Fe, New Mexico, who find themselves with a baby buffalo calf in their living room, and they're weaning it, for what purpose?
When Verl Goodnight, who is a Western artist and sculptor, found out that her ancestor had rescued the buffalo from extinction, not single-handedly, but almost, she decided to make a sculpture of Marianne Goodnight bottle feeding those original two calves. And to make this sculpture, she needed a calf to model for, because she works from life. So in 2000, she put out the word to ranchers and friends of hers she knew out west, you know, if you have a or hear of an orphaned calf, please let me know. She got a call from a rancher in Idaho and said a mother was separated from a one-year-old. We found him walking along the property. We can't reunite him with the herd. We have to bottle feed him, but he's yours if you want to come up and get him. And they flew up and they got this animal. They named him Charlie after Charles Goodnight. And for the next 4 months or so, he really was a buffalo in the house. He had the run of the house. A few hours a day he would model, which is something a baby bison can do as long as you're bottle feeding it, which of course was the subject of the sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
But then, like a large dog getting bigger every day, he roamed the house, he napped on sofas, he had accidents, he...
But buffalo don't have accidents, they have disasters.
it's true, almost a disaster of a, you know, on a national scale. So as he got older and began to break things and not back out of spaces, but turn around in spaces and wipe everything off countertops.
And if anybody's ever seen a buffalo, you could just imagine how this thing is just growing like crazy, and you have a buffalo in your house, and oh my goodness.
Well, when they get to be 3, 4, 5 months old, you'd be pretty foolish to let the buffalo have the run of the house. And predictably, Roger and Burl told Charlie he was going to now have to spend all his time outdoors.
Let's pick that up when we get back from the break. Folks, okay. Michael Olson here. This is The Food Chain. We're talking with Richard Rosen, author of A Buffalo in the House. And we do have a buffalo in the house. His name is Charlie. He's named after Charles Goodnight, who many, many years ago rescued the buffalo and saved them from extinction. And that's the story. Do stay tuned. Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking with Richard Rosen, author of A Buffalo in the House, and a fun read if you're heading to the beach and you want to read something really different. Here's a story about a couple in Santa Fe, New Mexico, who actually raise a baby buffalo in order to use it as a model for a sculptress. And the sculpture was of her great-aunt, Marianne Goodnight, who was bottle feeding two baby buffalo, and she needed a model for this baby buffalo, so they adopted one, and this buffalo kind of took over the house, did it not?
It did, and one of the reasons that it was able to spend so much time in the house, it's one of those animals who really tolerated people well, liked people, imprinted very well on Roger and Verl. That doesn't always happen with a wild animal, as you know. He became a member of the family, and interestingly, Roger Brooks started to fall in love with this animal, became utterly devoted to this animal, even though he knew at the age of 5 or 6 or 7 months they were going to have to tell Charlie he was a buffalo and introduce him to a herd of buffalo.
This is the most fascinating story about what happened when Charlie, the pet buffalo, was introduced to other buffaloes.
At the age of 7 months, this animal, who barely knew he was a buffalo, he'd only seen a couple buffalo in his life, was taken to...
He thought he was a person, right?
Or he thought Roger and Verl were buffalo.
One of the two, yeah, right.
But they took him to a herd a couple hours from their home in New Mexico and put him in a pen with two other teenage buffalo, thinking this would be a way to get him acclimated. That first night, and there are no human witnesses, but it's pretty clear that Charlie got spooked, turned tail, and ran headlong into a reinforced buffalo fence post, knocked himself silly, and he could not get up. He was temporarily paralyzed. To make a long story short, they got him up to Colorado State Veterinary...
And this is no small job, lugging a buffalo around that's incapacitated and can't move. Oh, my goodness.
There are no small jobs once the buffalo gets to be, you know, several hundred pounds. But they had a tougher job, which is to decide whether to put this animal down or not. And they were told at the College of Veterinary Medicine at Colorado State that there was very little chance that Charlie would walk again. If they were very, very lucky, he might be what they call pasture sound. He could stand up, but you wouldn't want to be near him for fear he would fall on you. Roger and Verl loved this animal so much that really to them, they had no choice. They had to do what they could, and they eventually took Charlie back home after he'd been rehabilitated a bit, and Roger began to devote a good portion of each day to helping a buffalo learn to walk again. Probably the first person in the history of the world to rehabilitate a buffalo.
I guess. Wow, what an experience that must have been. And he actually did get this buffalo up on his feet again, correct?
Yes.
Worked.
Got him walking around. When I met him, Charlie was 2 when I first met him, and he limped over to me in his corral. He did have a slight limp, but friendly as could be, went right for my crotch, you know, started licking that. That's what buffalo like to
That's
do with humans.
That's what buffalo, just like doggies, I guess.
Yeah.
Take us then to how this circle kind of closes here. We're starting to get a connection between Charles Goodnight back in the 1860s we're talking about?
Mm-hmm, 1870s.
Yeah, 1870s, and Verrill Goodnight in the early 2000s or 1990s. And they both become intimately connected with the buffalo. And we go back to Charles Goodnight then and Marianne Goodnight, who asked him to bring some buffalo in, and Charles brought the buffalo in, and they actually built a herd. And what did they attempt to do with this herd anyway? I mean, they're cattlemen. That's how they make their living. They got buffalo. What are they going to do with them?
Well, first of all, they admired buffalo. That's one reason they wanted to mm-hmm. preserve this animal.
Maybe this admiration is genetic then.
It could be, but it's also based on observing this animal,
mm-hmm.
whom Charles Goodnight knew was much smarter and more environmentally friendly than cattle. There's a reason that buffalo has survived for tens of thousands of years, where all the other early mammals perish. It's a very smart animal. It feeds intelligently. It doesn't graze grass down to the point where it can't grow again.
They kind of farm the prairie, don't they?
They farm the prairie. They rotate their range. They come back 2 years later to a place, and they roll around, and they shed seeds they've picked up elsewhere. To answer your question, the Goodnights raised this herd not because they expected to profit from it, and not because they thought that they were the easiest animals to handle. They respected the animal, and they wanted it to be part of the living world. And by the time Charles Goodnight died at the age of 93 in 1929, his herd was a few hundred, and he started giving pieces of it away. He gave 20 buffalo to the Taos Pueblo Indians, with whom he was very close. He always admired the Taos Pueblo. He gave them 20 buffalo. He donated 3 to Yellowstone.
3 buffalo?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And most of the rest of his herd is now in Texas, still in Texas.
Mm-hmm. So Charles Goodnight was kind of like the Johnny Appleseed of buffalo.
Yeah, yes.
Because he was going around seeding,
exactly.
Maybe unwittingly, but maybe wittingly. Maybe he knew what he was doing. Maybe he knew it.
You know, in those days, because there was hardly any communication, he could know that up north in Montana, there were a couple other people who were raising a herd.
Mm-hmm.
He might have thought, for all we knew, that he and Marianne were all that stood between the buffalo and total extinction.
Right.
And now, 130 years later, his descendant, Verrill Goodnight, and her husband, Roger Brooks, are now trying to save a single buffalo under extraordinary circumstances.
And we should note a little sidebar here that many farmers and ranchers throughout the West experimented with raising beefalo, which essentially are cattle and mm-hmm. bred with buffalo.
Sometimes called cattle-o.
Or cattle-o or beefalo, one of the two. And through that experimentation, what happened to the gene pool of bison or the great American buffalo?
Well, naturally, it became diluted. Today, the only purebred, continuously wild herd of buffalo is the one in Yellowstone. And
that's from the Goodnight herd in Texas.
That's from the Goodnight herd in Texas. I'm sorry, also the herd in Caprock Canyon State Park. That is also purebred. And in fact, the people who managed that herd in Texas realized that the gene pool was getting quite weak and inbred, even though it is pure. And so recently they've been trying to get other purebred bison to import to diversify and strengthen.
Okay, we're going to pick that up when we get back. Michael Olson, this is The Food Chain. We're talking with Richard Rosen, who is the author of A Buffalo in a House. It was a real buffalo in a real house, and it had this wonderful connection with saving the great American bison from extinction, dating back to the 1850s in Charles and Marianne Goodnight and up to the 1990s, and Verrill Goodnight. What a connection. Do stay tuned, right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking with Richard Rosen, author of A Buffalo in the House. And we're talking about a time when the gene pool of buffaloes became greatly, contaminated would be the word, with cattle genes because of all of the experimentation that went around. And the gene pool of the original buffalo, the pure 100% buffalo, became very, very small. Actually, they were able to count how many wild buffalo they had left. It was, 36, Richard?
In Texas, yes, 36 purebred buffalo.
Well, is that...
Of course, as they say, many of the buffalo in Yellowstone, if not all of them, are also purebred.
Mm-hmm. Is that enough, then, to save a herd when they're down to 36?
No, not at all. I mean, I'm not an expert on these matters, but there is a need for other purebred buffalo to be introduced to that herd in Texas to diversify the gene pool. And the perfect match for that herd in Texas is the Taos Pueblo herd. They have a herd of, let's say 60 or 100.
Mm-hmm.
And they also come from the Goodnight stock, the original Goodnight stock. So they are a perfect match, or certainly the best match for this group in Texas. But getting the Taos Pueblo Indians to sell or donate one or two buffalo from their herd has been harder than anybody thought. Roger Brooks, Charlie's father, has tried a couple times to get the Taos Pueblo to donate a couple of their bison to.
And you have a great reason why, because the administration of the Indian tribe changes every January, and what happens to the records?
The records seem to disappear. It's a curious thing, and again, I'm not...
They take starting over very literally, don't they?
When a new administration comes in, it's as if the history of the previous one vanishes.
Poof.
So that since it takes a while to do something like this to affect the transfer of some buffalo from them to a herd in Texas, it generally doesn't happen within a calendar year, even if they are willing to do it, and that's not clear.
So when we're talking about purebred buffalo, what do we have left?
Well, we have the 36 in Texas. We have the Taos Pueblo herd, which, as far as we know, derives completely from the 20 head that Charles Goodnight donated to the Taos Pueblo in 1929. And we probably can count on most, if not all, of the Yellowstone bison, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the only continuously wild bison that we have in this country. They've never been fenced in anywhere, and in fact, that's the cause of a lot of problems in Yellowstone.
Well, give us a thumbnail on the problems in Yellowstone, because we note with interest that there is a lot of contention going on up in Yellowstone with respect to the buffalo people and the cattle people.
Yes, and the controversy is still raging. There's no resolution yet in sight, but the issue basically is, in the spring, Yellowstone buffalo, the ones who are healthy enough, wander out of the park looking for early grass and a place to give birth in lower elevations. When they leave Yellowstone, which they do up the west side,
right,
they come under the jurisdiction of the Montana Department of Livestock. This is something the federal government, I guess under some pressure, allowed them to do. So now we have livestock people, cattle people, in charge of buffalo who come out of Yellowstone.
And the buffalo people and the cattle people have never mixed, have they?
Never mixed. And the cattle industry has a deep and historical antipathy to the buffalo. So what happens is many of these buffalo are being captured and then slaughtered. And the reason given, the official reason given for doing this, is to protect Montana's cattle from brucellosis, an infectious disease that bison carry. Also, I might add, elk carry, and nobody is demonizing elk.
Well, they have, there's a lot of
picking on the buffalo.
Yeah, there's a lot of demonizing of elk for the spongiform encephalopathies that they carry, but I haven't heard anybody go after them for the brucellosis at all.
And the interesting thing, of course, not of course, because most people, I guess, don't know this, or in Montana they know it but repress it, is there's no evidence of a single bison giving brucellosis to a cattle, to a cow in the wild.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't happen. And the reason it doesn't happen is because the only way to transmit brucellosis is for a buffalo cow to abort a baby and for a cattle to come by and to lick the aborted fetus. This is assuming, of course, the mother and the fetus are both infected. This is not something that happens very often. In fact, there's no record of it happening at all. So the cattle interests and cattle industry are giving brucellosis as an excuse to capture these stray buffalo out of Yellowstone.
And it probably has something to do with grazing rights, if I would make a guess at wild guess.
Yeah, I think that's a fair guess, that underneath it all, this is really about land.
Mm-hmm.
About grazing, and it's about the fear that if buffalo are allowed to wander out of Yellowstone, then that's like taking your finger out of the dike. And a lot of people fear that we'll have buffalo everywhere, and of course where there are buffalo, it's very hard to raise cattle. So the issue is not the disease. The issue is
the territory.
The land.
Sure. Well, as it usually is for just about everything. Michael Olson here. This is The Food Chain. We're talking with Richard Rosen, author of A Buffalo in the House. When we get back, we're going to conclude, but I have two questions for Richard when we get back. One is, what happened to Charlie the Buffalo down there in Santa Fe, New Mexico? And the other question is, does he think that there is a place, a home, for the buffalo to roam? Here in the United States, we have this big, beautiful country, but as we learned from the cattle people up in Montana, the buffalo are awfully threatening. So when we get back, we'll go for those questions and conclude with Richard Rosen. Do stay tuned.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food, or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day? Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to KnoxGardenBox.com. That's K-N-O-X, GardenBox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
We're back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're talking with Richard Rosen, author of A Buffalo in the House. So what did happen to Charlie the Buffalo down there in New Mexico?
Well, I don't want to give everything away for people who are going to take this book to the beach or elsewhere, but after a miraculous recovery with Roger's help, Charlie then got sick again, and because
let's leave it at that.
He got sick again. His troubles were not over.
Yeah.
His troubles were not over.
And do pick it up and take it to the beach. It is a worthwhile read, and it's a way to learn a lot about the country in which we live. So let's go to the broader question, and the one that probably has no answer is, do you think that there can ever be a home for buffalo to roam in the United States again?
I do. I think there's a lot of land available right now. There are a lot of issues that have to be resolved in order for these buffalo to be transferred and safely fenced in. The Great Plains is filled with a lot of land. Some people think up to a quarter of the land, which is of no economic value at all. It cannot support anything anymore, and the population in these counties has been declining.
So we're kind of talking about the Buffalo Commons, aren't we?
We are talking about the Buffalo Commons, which was intended as a metaphor, not as an actual plan to release buffalo into the Great Plain. The fact is, there is a lot of useless, played-out land that's barely populated. And the thing about the buffalo is they can replant that land for you. They can maintain it.
What do you mean?
Well,
we talked earlier about how buffalo farm the land, but what do you mean?
Once you get prairie grasses growing again, they, unlike cattle, will not destroy that land. They know, and only evolution has the answer to this, they know how to graze grass down to the ground without destroying it so that it has a chance to grow back. The herds migrate, they come back later, they have seeds in their coats, and when they wallow, they actually replant the grass, but the grass has been given a chance to grow back by them anyway. And there is a vision a lot of people have of buffalo roaming on the Great Plains once again. And certainly in Montana, there is available land for buffalo. Montana talks about its cattle industry, but Montana produces only 2.5% of this country's beef cattle.
Mm-hmm.
It is not a big industry. There are a lot of very wealthy people there with trophy herds, and they're politically powerful. And if they were a little bit more generous toward the buffalo, there's no question they could find some land.
A whole bunch more Ted Turners, right?
A whole bunch more Ted Turners.
Mm-hmm. And Ted, for his part, has really been doing a lot to bring back the buffalo, too. And he's trying to do it as an economic crop, telling people, look, this is good meat here, folks.
Right. Well, of course, the paradox here, if you're an animal lover, is you can't keep buffalo unless you can make some money doing it, and you do it by raising buffalo meat, which is lower in fat content than almost any meat, including chicken.
Right.
So it's a healthy alternative.
Okay, folks, there you go. Richard Rosen, a buffalo in the house. It's hard to imagine having a buffalo in the house, but that's exactly what they did down there in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And we ask you out there, what do you think? Can there be a place where buffalo roam free? I want to thank you, Richard, for joining us today. We want to thank you all for tuning in. We hope you see you all next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here on the Food Chain. And remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.